From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 24 million North Koreans got the news this morning, Pyongyang time, that their dear leader and dictator, Kim Jong-il, is dead. Word is that his little-known young son, Kim Jong-un, will succeed him. North Korea is a kind of nuclear-armed time capsule of 20th century war wounds and paranoia, propaganda, starvation, nationalism. When it's on edge, it tends to lash out. It must be on edge now. Its reach is longer than ever. This hour, On Point, death of a dictator, and what comes next for Korea and the world. You can join the conversation. Have you heard the emotion in the broadcasts today out of North Korea? Where does that emotion go? Do you see a change for the better or worse on the Korean peninsula? Do you think things there will change at all now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Emotion of an unusual kind when North Korea opens its airwaves to the world. Here, a North Korean broadcaster breaking down while announcing the death of Kim Jong-il.
너무도 갑자기, 너무도 애석하게.
It's a big moment in a different world. Joining me now from Beijing first today is Evan Osnos, China correspondent for The New Yorker. Evan, welcome back to One Point. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
How has this news been received in China? It was out of the blue. Kim Jong-il had had heart problems, but no one knew or expected that it would be this weekend. Right now, his successor is young. How's China looking at what's going on?
Well, for China, this is obviously a big local story. I mean, North Korea shares an enormous border with China, and for years, China has worried about one thing, which is the prospect of a collapse in North Korea, which could unleash millions of refugees over the border. I mean, quite literally, this time of year, the Tumen River is frozen, which is the border between North Korea and China, and that's the principal route by which a lot of North Korean refugees have made their way in past years. So right now, the leadership in Beijing is huddled and thinking about what they need to do in order to prevent some sort of immediate collapse.
In the past 18 months, Kim Jong-il, who very rarely travels abroad, was in China four times. They talked, you know, about a lot of things. I guess they vowed their alliance would be sealed in blood, that it would pass on to successors. China's got its own leadership change coming up. What about this relationship and the extent of China's sway, its influence with North Korea?
The relationship is unique in the sense that there is no other country on the planet right now that has the kind of influence on North Korea that China does. It's its largest supplier of food, fuel, arms. And historically, they've described themselves in the Chinese term as close as lips and teeth. But in fact, that expression has always been a bit of a charade because in recent years, of course, China has gone in one direction and North Korea has gone in another. China has embraced economic reforms, a sort of recipe of political control and prosperity at the same time. Essentially, you can get rich and you can still prevent democracy from taking hold. That was what China was trying to preach to Kim Jong-il in recent years. And part of the reason for all of these visits has been for China to try to make that case. But one of the things that was remarkable about Kim Jong-il was that to the end, he persisted in his own way, and he said, I am not ready to go the Chinese way. I think for him, there was too much uncertainty about it, and he wasn't willing to take the chance.
The scenario of collapse that would send thousands across that 800 or 900 mile border from North Korea into China, how would that unfold? Many people have said that at the moment of succession was a moment to worry about that. This is an untested young man, his third son, apparently coming up to fill his shoes. If there were a collapse scenario from the Chinese perspective, what might the shape of that be? What would that look like?
You know, at this point, in a strange way, I think because there is so much concern and attention about the possibility of an immediate collapse, that this is actually perhaps not the moment of greatest vulnerability. Because over the next 72 hours, the next 2 weeks, I mean, the body will be lying in state from the 20th to the 27th. There will be a great elaborate funeral. That's a period in which internally in North Korea, they will be sorting out who's going to be in charge, who will take the spoils of which parts of the government. The period that worries me most is, in fact, the period after that, because that's when the immediate moment of crisis has passed. And in fact, that's when we don't really know what comes next. You know, North Korea has not had it's had three leaders in its entire existence as the Democratic People's Republic. And that means that this is a moment of enormous vulnerability, and what comes next will depend in part on how the rest of the world responds, I think.
Evan Osnos, China correspondent for The New Yorker, watching all the unfolding events in North Korea today from Beijing. Thank you, Evan, very much for joining us.
Sure, Tom.
Hear the sound of mourners gathered today at the statue of Kim Jong-il's father, Kim Il-sung, in Pyongyang. And it wasn't just the mourners in the streets. Here are North Korean officials weeping after the announcement of Kim Jong-il's death. The sound of another world. We're talking today about the death of a dictator, North Korea's Kim Jong-il. Joining me right now in the studio, Ambassador Stephen Bosworth, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He served as ambassador in a number of posts around Asia and beyond, and in 2009 was named by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as Special Representative for North Korea Policy for the United States, a position he held until October of this year. Ambassador Stephen Bosworth, great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
I guess let's go to instability first. How loose and unpredictable a moment might this be over the next 2 weeks, months in North Korea?
Well, a time of transition like this is, of course, always possible that we'll see some tentative instability. But I would be surprised, frankly, if this gets out of control in any significant way. The North Koreans have been preparing for this for some time, ever since Kim Jong-il suffered his stroke in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
They have in place what looks to be a workable framework for transition. Kim Jong-un's uncle, Chung Sung-taek, who is also married to his aunt, obviously,
mm-hmm.
Is, I think, going to act pretty much as a regent or guide and supervise this transition.
The aunt being the blood relative
mm-hmm. of Kim Jong-il.
So by marriage, he's right in the middle.
Right, exactly.
What kind of position does Kim Sung-taek, the uncle, have? Is he in the military? Is he high in the party? Both?
No, he's high in the party. He's not a military man, but he was a longtime confidant most of the time of Kim Jong-il, although he was exiled for a time in the about 10 years ago. But he's come back, and I think he's generally regarded as the point of continuity within the regime. And I think that's going to be the focus of the next several months, the establishment of continuity. I don't expect any new strategies, new programs. I think they will want to remain engaged with the outside world to the extent that they're engaged with the outside world. But I think they're unlikely to launch any new offensive. Also, it's important to remember that going into 2012, that's a very important year.
Why?
For the North Korean regime, because it's the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung.
Mm.
And in their sort of creation—
The great first revolutionary
exactly,
leader. Mm-hmm.
And in their creation myth— this is a very important anniversary, and they've been talking for some time about being able to demonstrate that they're opening the gate to economic prosperity in 2012. So I think it's unlikely they're going to want to do anything that throws a wrench into that, and they're going to be stressing continuity of policy and purpose.
Now, continuity can sound good in a moment of crisis or a moment of succession. On the other hand, continuity in this regime, this is a regime that has, with some regularity, had famines, starvation. It has been very belligerent any number of times and sometimes quite unpredictably, even just as you well know in the last couple of years, attacking South Korean points. They've developed nuclear weapons over Kim Jong-il's time. I mean, continuity is hardly, if it's continuous with what North Korea has been doing, and they've exported that nuclear technology, it hardly looks like a primrose path.
Well, no, it's not a primrose path, and it's a situation the United States has to be deeply concerned about and continue to follow very closely. My only point was that the transition itself, I don't think, is necessarily a time when we should expect the emergence of a new crisis.
What about the notion that Kim Jong-un, the apparent successor, is little cemented with the military? He's been made a four-star general with essentially no experience behind him in the military. that the way of proving one's mettle as a Korean leader is to make some dramatic military gesture. What about that fear, concern?
Well, there are some who believe that he was implicit or complicit in the sinking of the naval vessel of the South Koreans last year.
Beginning to show his chops, his strength.
Mm. On the other hand, we have no real confirmation of that. We don't know much about the guy. We know he went to middle school in Switzerland for a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
We've had no contact with him. But it does seem, from the outside at least, that the military, by and large, has accepted him. Now, he's going to rule in a very different way than did his father. He's going to be, I think, tightly bound into the structure of leadership provided by
a committee around him.
Committee. The military is going to be, in some ways, the supreme arbiter. And I think Chung Sung-taek is going to play a key role.
Can you see North Korea, after all the struggle that it has gone through, while South Korea has boomed and developed, and China has as well, can you see it in this next chapter, briefly in the 30 seconds we've got before the break here, turning over a leaf, reforming, adopting a new economic sort of way, maybe the China way?
I doubt it. I think the China way for them looks to be too hazardous, too risky. They're a smaller country. They don't have the extensive overseas network the Chinese had. I think they understand the importance of economic reform, but to them, it poses an unacceptable level of political risk.
Opening up that way would make them too vulnerable to who knows.
That's right. They've been confronting this for 15 years.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the death of a dictator today, North Korea's Kim Jong-il. The anthem behind us, No Motherland Without You, extolling Kim Jong-il's achievements as North Korean leader. Today, Pyongyang time, the news that he is dead. We're looking at the changing of the guard, at least the top, the very top, in the world's most closed, perhaps, country. What this means for Korea, the Korean Peninsula, its neighbors, and the United States. You can join the conversation this hour. What are you thinking on the death of Kim Jong-il? What about the rise of his son, Kim Jong-un? Koreans, how do you see the significance of this death, this succession, this change? And when, if ever, will North Korea come out of its shell, its isolation? Will it ever? And how and why? The emotion in the announcement, we've heard it again and again. Here's another North Korean broadcaster on KRT announcing the death of 17-year North Korean leader, dictator Kim Jong-il.
위대한 용도자 김정일 동지께서 주체 100, 2011년 12월 17일.
There's obviously a kind of theater in any nation at the moment of a leader's death. That's a very high, kind of high tier of emotion in this particular North Korean theater. Across the border, in South Korea, two South Koreans in Seoul, the capital of South Korea, spoke to the BBC about their reactions to Kim Jong-il's death.
He died well before the hereditary succession ends, but we have to be on alert since the North Korean situation is bad, maybe about to collapse. There's a possibility that they would invade us.
They could provoke an attack accidentally. We have our military forces along with the United Nations and the United States forces stationed here. In my personal opinion, I can trust them, and they are well ready.
Voices from North Korea looking across the border as the world watches North Korea, with the death announced just in the last day of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. Ambassador Stephen Bosworth is with me in the studio, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And for the last couple of years, he has been, up until just October of this year, U.S. Special Envoy, Special Representative for North Korea policy. Joining us as well now from Washington is Victor Cha. He holds the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies from 04 to 07, served as Director for Asian Affairs at the White House on the National Security Council. Victor Cha, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're being quoted all over the place today saying if anybody had asked you what would be the most likely scenario in which the North Korean regime would collapse, the answer would be the sudden death of Kim Jong-il. Here we've got the sudden death. What about the collapse?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know. You know, quite frankly, we don't know what the future holds. But, you know, I think one of the things that we've learned, particularly these past couple of years, is you could get massive political change in the Middle East or in other parts of the world, and afterwards people would point to all these factors saying, sure, you know, we're not surprised it happened, whether it was in Egypt, you know, unemployment, youth bulge, Twitter. My point is basically in the North Korean case, if something were to happen, people would look back and say, this should not be surprising at all. Sudden death of the leader, economic problems, food problems, isolated regime, young, inexperienced leadership, we should not be surprised at all.
What can you tell us about the successor, Kim Jong-un, himself, and what you anticipate from his rule, I guess, as Stephen Bosworth says, along with those around him?
Well, I mean, you know, Steve is sort of the true expert on this, and I would defer to him if we have a difference of view. I mean, I think that this North Korean leader, you know, next leader, the great successor, is not particularly ready. Kim Jong-il, when he was being groomed to replace his father, Kim Il-sung, basically had 14 to 15 years to prepare for mm-hmm. this. This young fellow has much less than that. He's had maybe 2.5-3 years. We don't know whether he's built a coterie of leadership around him. The people that are around him, some are rumored also to be quite sick, including Kim Jong-il's sister.
Mm-hmm.
And that leaves basically the uncle and the young son. We don't know if the military fully supports him yet. I mean, he was promoted to general last September, a four-star general, and has never served a day in the military. You would have to imagine that even in North Korea, that would make some military a little upset. So lots of questions. You know, there are just lots of questions about what comes next. I just feel like I could not imagine a less ideal set of circumstances under which they try to transfer to this third dynastic succession.
Are you saying simply there because of the suddenness of Kim Jong-il's death or something else in the current circumstances?
Well, I think the suddenness of the death, the lack of any clear signals before the death that this succession was well underway and that there were no problems. For every story that you heard that there were no problems with the succession, you heard other stories that said there were problems. So there's nothing that gives one confidence. And then to have Kim Jong-un suddenly die like this really sort of pulls the rug out from under the table.
Ambassador Stephen Bosworth, how do you imagine Pyongyang will present this change to its own population? They've been through a lot. They've been through a lot for a long time. They have a very unique kind of creation myth, as you say, and sense of themselves in the world. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But what about presenting Kim Jong-un to the country? You've got a question here from a listener online saying, what are they going to call the new guy, new leader, after the great leader, Kim Il-sung, the dear leader, Kim Jong-il? Is there a moniker for the new leader?
Well, they've been calling him either the great general or they now, I gather, are calling him the great successor.
The great general who's been a four-star general for like 5 minutes and with
real
experience.
That's right. No, I agree very much with Victor that this is hardly a propitious moment for this to occur. What I am saying, however, mm-hmm. is that I think that the North Korean regime is welded together by a common fear of what would happen to them if they indeed splinter. So I think the military is likely to remain unified and in support of Kim Jong-un. They have no real alternative.
Here's a question from a listener online. Jason says, I think this kid, I guess he means the new leader, is marginalized and pushed aside within a year. Will a military dictatorship, rather than a cult of personality, his question is, lead to a more rational foreign policy? Burma's an interesting example. Victor Shaw, what do you think?
Again, anything is possible, but I think in this particular case, we have to remember that the military dictatorship, the leadership, right, what we call the leadership in North Korea, is basically a leadership that has seen several formative events, right, in international relations. They've seen the Chinese almost lose power in Tiananmen Square. They've seen all these dictatorships and authoritarian regimes in the Middle East with leaders who were in power longer than Kim Jong-il all collapse. They've seen South Korea boom as an economy, leaving the North far behind. They've seen the Soviet Union and the Eastern European satellites all collapse. This is not a world that is very conducive to creating the view among a North Korean leadership that, oh yeah, you know, we can simply reform and everybody will accept us. I mean, the problem always for the North Korean leadership is, unlike China, the North Korean leadership is not willing to get rich at the expense of losing political control. In China, Deng Xiaoping said to get rich is glorious, and the Chinese were willing to take that step to loosen political control in order to make money. There is no Deng Xiaoping in North Korea, one. And two, they think political control is still more important than money. So for those reasons, it's really hard to imagine that this regime, particularly after the sudden death of Kim Jong-il, is all of a sudden going to do a 180 and say, we're ready to open up to the world.
Victor Chow, we've just got you for another minute. What about threat factors here? North Korea has lashed out before, and more than lashing out, I mean, they've sent nuclear technology, missile technology around the world. How would you size up threat factors over this transition period as we sit here today to their immediate neighbor, South Korea, to Japan? They've had missiles head in Japan's direction in recent years, to the United States.
Yeah. Well, again, I think Steve's much more qualified to answer this as being a former ambassador in Korea and his position in the Obama administration. I mean, for me, the first priority is ensuring safety of U.S. citizens and troops and allies on the peninsula. But the thing that I'm most concerned about is when we get the first news, from the news media, from intelligence, that there is some sort of instability in North Korea. When that first news comes up, it raises the whole specter of who has control of the nuclear weapons, who has control of the ballistic missiles, who has control of the conventional artillery. I mean, these all become very salient questions immediately. They're kind of bubbling beneath the surface now, and the military folks, I'm sure, are working very hard on these questions. But that's the thing that concerns me more than some sort of overt attack by the North Koreans.
Victor Cha, holding the chair in the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, it's great to talk with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ambassador Bosworth, what about the threat factors? You've been in charge of interpreting and interacting. I think you were in the region just last summer. You've spoken with North Korean representatives just in the last few months. All right, what about the threat factor to our ally South Korea, Japan, and ourselves as we sit here today?
It's always there, and we can never be confident that the North Koreans won't do something that appears to us to be irrational and appears to them to be consistent with their policy aims, which boil down to a strong desire, obviously, for the survival of their regime. But I think that it's unlikely that they're going to launch on any new policy initiative in the foreseeable future. And I agree basically with Victor. I think the prospect of their making a 180 and beginning to open up to institute serious economic reform, at least in the short to medium term, is very, very bleak.
Let's go to Blarina calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Blarina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
I just wanted to share a little bit of my experience. I came from Albania. I grew up there, and I was 6 years old when the regime, when our dictator died. His name was Enver Hoxha.
Yes.
And we had a very similar dictatorship like North Korea, totally isolated from the West and East.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had just one partner, China, which we cut off at the end.
So did you have crisis or continuity after that death, Blarina?
I'm sorry?
Did you have crisis or continuity after the death?
No, that's what I was going to share with you all, that after he died in 1985, nothing changed. And it took Albania 5 years, 1990, when we started our own demonstrations. And it wasn't because of internal will. The population was too weak, too disorganized. It was only because the things happened outside. It was the Berlin Wall that fell, the Russia Confederation that fell, and all those happened that made the population be aware that we can do something internally. And I think the North Korea people are too weak to, they're not organized, they're too blind, they're too, too drugged, and the administration is very strong. And whether it's apparently weak leader, an experienced leader, I don't think it matters that much as long as the institution and the army is strong and they have too much of a stake to give up and start reforms.
A little comparative politics there on dictatorships from an Albanian looking on North Korea. Stephen Bosworth, what about this characterization? She's guessing from another experience that these people, the North Koreans, are too weak, too blind. They're not in a position or in a mindset to push back against this leadership.
I must say, we haven't seen any example or any evidence that the people are preparing to push back. On the other hand, it's unlikely that we would see that from the outside. I think a good analogy here is that we know that the North Koreans have been looking very particularly at Libya. And in fact, their state media...
In the fall of Gaddafi,
the fall
you mean?
Of Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. And their state media said a few months ago, look, that's what happens when you give up your nuclear program. Mm-hmm. NATO would never have dared do this mm-hmm. had Gaddafi had nuclear weapons. I think that experience makes it even more difficult to persuade the North Koreans to give up their nuclear program.
They may cling all the more tightly after having witnessed that. Patty in Boston is calling. Hi, Patty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Love your show, by the way. I just couldn't help myself. I needed to call and ask this question. Mm-hmm. Aside from the political and the economic impact that this is going to have, the death of this leader, I can't help myself but ask the question after listening to all the reports of all the media people and all the officials breaking down and crying. You know, does that reflect people's goodness, or that this man perhaps did do something good, or what kind of impact did he have for people to react this way to his death?
Yeah.
And I will take my answer offline. Thank you.
That's a really great question, Patty. Let me go right to Korea to help us look into what we've seen since the death, to Seoul, South Korea, and Brian Myers. He's with us. He's author of the book, The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. He teaches North Korean ideology at Dongseo University. He's head of the International Studies Department there, an American citizen, but been in South Korea for a long time. Brian Myers, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You hear our caller Patty's question. We're all seeing the images and listening to the sound of North Koreans weeping, kind of literally sort of tearing their hair and clearly very distressed. It's hard to know how to interpret this. Patty says, you know, is it possible they really loved this leader, Kim Jong-il? How do you interpret what we see?
Well, I think there's certainly a certain amount of dissembling. I mean, we know from North Korean refugees that they felt greatly pressured to at least pretend to be crying after Kim Il-sung died when they had months and months of mourning ceremonies. But we also heard from the same refugees that there was an awful lot of really heartfelt sorrow. I think commingled with that are also, I think, tears of fear. We know from South Koreans, for example, that when the dictator Park Chung-hee was assassinated in 1979, many people burst into tears, not because they were so sad at losing him, but because they were afraid of how South Korea would be able to hold up without the leader, or the only leader that they had known. Of course, these are the kinds of emotions that the propaganda apparatus has very skillfully tried to instill in the people. I think it attests to the success of the political culture in North Korea.
Ambassador Bosworth, how do you interpret the displays of emotion we've all seen in the last 12 hours?
I think some of it is relatively sincere. It's been manipulated by the regime without question. But I think we have to remember, and I've always considered that North Korea in many ways is a semi-religious cult. I've called it the Heaven's Gate of international politics. And I think that shapes some of the reaction. We do know on the other hand, as your caller, your mm-hmm. guest in Seoul has said, that the regime does manipulate this. And from North Korean refugees, we've been able to verify that. But I think there is a certain element of sincerity, and I think your guest is probably right. Much of that comes from fear.
Fear of not appearing to react appropriately, or fear of the outside world
Both.
Of the kind that...
Fear, mm-hmm. fear of not not being seen to react appropriately, but also fear of the unknown, fear of change.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the death of a dictator, North Korea's Kim Jong-il, the changing of the guard, at least at the very top, in the world's most closed country, what this means for Korea, its neighbors, for the United States. You know, it's a very buttoned-up country, certainly to the outside. Here's some 2005 North Korean government film of a military parade in Pyongyang, the narrator singing the praises of Kim Jong-il, now deceased.
The seasoned leadership of Kim Jong-il, the brilliant Sun Gun General, who strengthens the revolutionary armed forces to be invincible, has made it possible to develop an army of competent military commanders who are equipped with a Juche-orientated military thought and methods of rule.
Brilliant, invincible, future-oriented. Not everybody's in on that. Here's sound of anti-North Korea demonstrators in Seoul, South Korea, shortly after the news arrived of Kim Jong-il's death. Shouting out against North Korea from across that fraught border. Ambassador Stephen Bosworth is with us this hour. He is dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Until just October, was special representative for North Korea policy for the Obama administration. Brian Myers is with us from Seoul, South Korea, author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. Let's go to our listeners, Susan in Harvard, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Interesting topic. I'm glad you're addressing it.
Great.
My comment is, we had a caller that said, you know, I wonder if the people crying and being so distraught, is that real or is that staged? And I was thinking that if you have a country that is dominated by a ruler that is like a father figure, that when you lose that figure, there's an intense grief, and they would feel like they're on a boat with no rudder.
Susan, let us pick that up, and I'll take it to Brian Myers. This gets into his neck of the woods. And, Brian, here's another comment from a listener. Rex online says, I don't believe these crying North Koreans are faking it. They pretty much have nothing. They've been brainwashed to believe that he was almighty and infallible. They're not allowed to think for themselves. To break down in tears over the leader's death is all they know to do. Take us further into the sort of giant thought bubble around North Korea that might lead to that kind of reaction, Brian.
Well, we need to get away from the notion the notion of brainwashing, which implies that you have sort of a mad scientist regime which is ladling ideas into the brains of its citizens
okay.
who really are just too passive to resist it. Propaganda is a give and take, just like advertising is a give and take. The people need significance. They need to impart significance to their lives, as we all do. We do that in the West through consumerism and what have you, and we burst out in tears when Michael Jackson dies, for example.
Mm.
The North Korean regime is an ultra-nationalist state, and I don't mean nationalism in the sense of extreme patriotism. I mean it in the sense of race-based nationalism of the kind that we saw in the 1930s. And psychologically, that's an enormously appealing doctrine. It works especially well because it is just as adapted to bad economic times as it is to good ones. When things go badly, you blame the outsiders.
You're talking race-based nationalism of the type we saw in the 1930s. That would be the Nazis in Germany or even Japan in that period, Brian Myers. See, it sounds as though we may have lost Brian for a moment. Ambassador Bosworth, what do you make of that characterization? It's central to Brian's interpretation of what he sees in North Korea.
I think there's something to that. As I said earlier, that North Korea in some ways can be best understood as a religious cult.
And the religion, race, blood, the racial purity?
Racial purity, the notion that the North Koreans have nothing to envy about the outside world, that they are to be envied, in fact, because of the purity of their leadership, because of the purity of their race. And remember, their creation myth comes from the Japanese period when they were being colonized by the Japanese, their fight against the Japanese, and then after World War II, their effort to consolidate their rule over all of South Korea. So there is a good deal to what Brian was saying.
Brian Myers, in South Korea, you're citing the Nazi period, the Japanese period early in the 20th century. How does an idea of racial purity and supremacy come from having been colonized by the Japanese? It might look like a contradiction. Take us into that, Brian.
Yeah, well, the strange thing about North Korea's race-based nationalism is that they perceive the Korean race as being only morally superior to the rest of the world. They are not physically or intellectually superior, according to the propaganda. But because they are morally superior to everybody else, they are more vulnerable. In other words, the North Koreans see themselves as being, so to speak, the children on the world stage who are too good to survive without the protective care of a loving parental leader. And, of course, that was the role that Kim Jong-il fulfilled. So it's not an expansionist nationalism of the kind that we saw in Japan or in Nazi Germany. That's the key difference.
not expansionist, but this sense of superiority that sees everybody else as inferior. And by that, then, Brian, justifies any kind of step to defend the North Korean state?
Exactly. It also justifies flouting any kind of international conventions and laws that you make, because if you believe that your race is morally purer than every other race, it stands to reason that every contract, every deal that you sign with an inferior race can and should be flouted if it serves the interests of the Korean people.
But what about when there's mass starvation, Stephen Bosworth, which there was in the time of Kim Jong-il? I mean, you can talk purity all you want. When people are starving in the huge numbers, doesn't that wear thin?
Well, I think it does. I think there is some evidence that during the famine of the 1990s, the regime did suffer a significant erosion of support from below. We know that from the stories told by defectors. And I think that they're less unified, less committed than they were probably 15 years ago. Nonetheless, there is a degree of commitment which, by our standards in the West, seems extraordinary.
Let's go to Carl in Boston. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks. I want to make it clear that I'm not attempting to be funny or provocative by this statement, but my concern is, why don't we just simply attack North Korea and get this over with? We have this habit in both North Korea and Cuba, just waiting and waiting and waiting. Meanwhile, we're paying billions of dollars. We're defending Japan. This all seems ridiculous to me. We had no trouble assassinating Allende in Chile. We had no trouble getting rid of the Iranian democratically elected leader in the 1950s. George Bush had no problem with shock and awe in Afghanistan. Saddam Hussein didn't even have weapons of mass destruction. And we got 9 years and $800 billion of that.
Yeah, Carl, I think we've got the gist. There's some very hard-nosed form of realpolitik. Why not just rip the Band-Aid off, attack them, take this regime out? Stephen, Ambassador Bosworth, I'll put that to you.
Well, I think the answer to that is because they have the ability, if they were to so choose, to do great damage to people in the region. South Korea, 20 million people in South Korea live within range of the North Korean artillery.
And that artillery is massive.
Massive. They could put several hundred artillery shells per minute into downtown Seoul. And they also have some nuclear capability. So the notion that we just have to be tough with them and all will fall into place is just wrong-headed.
What about Japan's vulnerability? We saw that, wasn't it, overflights of Japan by North Korean missiles?
The Japanese feel very vulnerable. The North Korean missiles do have the capability to reach Japan.
Brian Myers, do you see this as a standoff without end if the risks of that kind of approach are so great? Or do you see something within North Korea that will naturally lead to unspooling this very tight reclusiveness?
Well, I think we have seen just a general cooling of ardor in the past 20 years, and I think that's going to continue. I don't expect, you know, sudden Arab Spring type situation there, but just the loss of fervor, the loss of ardor for the state poses a problem for it. On the other hand, something that we haven't talked about in this whole hour really is the fact that South Korea is shifting to the left as we speak. It's in all likelihood you're going to see a left-wing government return to power in South Korea, and that means a massive infusion of unilateral unconditional aid for Pyongyang. So if they can hold out until then, if they can hold out for another year, that they might well be past the crisis. I think you cannot explain North Korea's survival without understanding that the South Korean state does not really have the courage of its own convictions. This is one of the least popular republics in the world, according to opinion polls. When the South Koreans look at their flag, they don't see the republic. They see the race. They see the nation. They see the bloodline. And that's something that is more likely actually to make them feel solidarity with North Korea.
Ambassador Bosworth, what about this very fraught relationship, all the ties of history and blood there on this peninsula, and yet this sharp division in the 20th century? I mean, I was with former South Korean President Kim Dae-jung when he first came back from kind of exile to South Korea. He, of course, opened this relationship up as it had not been since the Cold War. Where do you see South Korea's attitude turning in the years ahead toward its northern brothers, sisters, neighbors?
There continues to be a division within the South Korean polity over how to deal with the North. The so-called progressives, on the one hand, as represented by Kim Dae-jung, believe that you can build bridges of understanding to them, that eventually over a long period of time you can incorporate them into the South Korean system. On the other hand, the conservatives, as represented by Lee Myung-bak over the last 5 years, mm-hmm. believe that you have to be tough and firm with North Korea. This poses a certain dilemma for the United States because we find it difficult to—
It's our ally and it goes this sure, way then that.
Exactly. But I think that there is a growing belief in South Korea that they are condemned, if you will, to live with this neighbor. I don't think it's appropriate for the U.S. to try to tell them how they should relate to North Korea in terms of more aid, less aid, whatsoever. As long as we can do things in some with some element of coordination, they have a commitment to us not to do things unexpectedly or unilaterally, and we have a commitment to them to maintain our posture of deterrence and support.
Well, it takes a kind of patience, though, Brian Myers, to over so many years maintain. Maybe there's no choice, but I mean, here, North Korea, you know, fired on the South Korean ship, we're told, fired on the South Korean island just in the last year or two, to maintain this equanimity, even with a range of reactions, with all that hostility from the North.
Well, you know, I think it's ironic I think it's unfair, really, that people are characterizing President Lee's North Korea policy as being a hardline one. I mean, this man, this Republic of Korea, South Korea, took two attacks and did not retaliate in any significant way. Yep. I don't think anybody would think an American president under those circumstances was a hardliner. I think the danger, really, something that's being overlooked, is the danger of South Korea conveying an unwillingness to defend itself. I think we need to remember that the Korean War started in 1950 because Kim Il-sung was convinced and was also able to persuade Mao Zedong and Stalin that the South Koreans would not defend themselves. All he had to do was take Seoul, and the rest of the country would rise up. Mm. And in this, to that extent, I think this strong shift to the left that you've seen in South Korea, with every election after those attacks bringing more left-wingers into power, is a very dangerous factor in the mix, but it's a very positive factor for the survival of the North Korean state. As I say, South Korea does not have really the courage or is not convinced enough of its own legitimacy to lay a claim to the whole peninsula. And I think that's going to continue to benefit North Korea.
Ambassador Stephen Bosworth, what about that perspective? It's kind of the tough line from Brian Myers.
Well, I don't disagree with it, but I do think that it may be somewhat premature. South Korea is going to have National Assembly elections in the spring, and they're going to have a presidential election next December. I think it's a little early to judge that there has been some shift of the pendulum back toward the left forces in South Korea. Let's wait and see. I've always considered South Korea a bit of a tin pot, not in the
meaning.
Meaning it heats up in a hurry and it cools off in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Condolences from China. News just coming in today. AP reporting deep condolences on the death of Kim Jong-il and the Communist Party's Central Committee in China, hailing the apparent successor, Kim Jong-un, as North Korea's new leader, saying longstanding ties will flourish between the countries. Ed in Brookline, Massachusetts. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Stephen, Brian, I'd like to suggest that I agree with much of what Ambassador Bosworth has said. I disagree strongly with Brian and with the caller who said we should just pull off the Band-Aid. This is a very dangerous situation, and we shouldn't do anything sudden. We need to be watchful and alert, and troops need to be on a heightened state of alert, but we should not do anything either rhetorically or on the ground that makes the North Koreans feel that they're about to be attacked. A war there would be a complete disaster. Brian would not be broadcast talking to us from Busan if a war breaks out with us attacking North Korea or with South Korea attacking North Korea.
Ed, let us pick it up right there, if I may. Forgive me, but our time is short. Brian Myers, there's a kind of, hey, let's settle down, cool your jets plea from our caller. What do you say?
I think the caller just missed my whole point, which is that the Korean War started because South Korea conveyed an unwillingness to defend itself. That war came about because the South Koreans looked as if they weren't going to defend themselves. And this is why I'm worried, precisely because I live here on the peninsula. I do not want war to break out, and I think the South Koreans are mistaken to think that they can keep allowing themselves to be attacked and not even cut off economic ties and think that somehow the North Koreans are going to just start relaxing. It's not that kind of a system. I would agree completely with the caller, though, that we should not be provoking North Korea, rhetorically or otherwise. But I think that when South Korea is attacked, it needs...
Let's look at this another way for a moment, Ambassador Bosworth. Here's a listener. Dan says, if we're going to speculate, he thinks that Kim Jong-un, the new leader, will take a year or two, strengthen his position, then begin to slowly open North Korea. As he does, he'll allow in foreign investment, tightly controlled modernization to prepare his nation for reunification sometime in the next decade. If he does it correctly, he could be the ruler of a unified Korea in the 2020s or 2030s.
Well, I would agree with the first part of that, at least that it's possible that that's a course of action he will take. I think
opening up.
I think if he believes he's going to be the ruler of a unified Korea, he's delusional. That's just not going to happen.
Why would he even open up, given everything we've heard today?
That was my earlier point. Mm-hmm. I think they should open up in their own self-interest, but that's a very difficult position or decision for them to take, given what they've seen around the world, particularly over the last year or two. What happens to regimes who have been very tight mm-hmm. and try to open up and loosen up.
But can they stay tight perpetually in this century with all the advances going on around them?
I've been working with this problem for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And for almost 20 years, the underlying premise of those out on the outside trying to deal with North Korea has been that eventually they're going to collapse. Maybe they will collapse at some point. But I think that is not a sufficient base for policy.
Ambassador Stephen Bosworth, U.S. Special Envoy, representative on North Korea policy until just October of this year, now Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Thank you for being here. And Brian Myers in Seoul, South Korea, author of The Cleanest Race. Thank you, Brian, for your time today. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.